Morning, everybody. Want some money? Okay, you come to the wrong place. That was this morning. You guys should have gone to the USDA talk. The head guy from USDA was here. He has all the money. Sorry, this thing drives me nuts. Okay, I'm Ron Turco. I'm at Purdue University. My co-authors are Leslie Oliver at University of Kentucky. She used to be at Purdue, and Denise Wardrop from Penn State. She's contributed on this also, so that's sort of where I am. Looking for a clicker. We'll just try this approach. Here we go. So what do you get when you cross a wildcat, I guess that's what that is, and a polar maker? Well, you get the following. You get a similar perspective, and the perspective is in terms of grant money. And what Leslie does at the University of Kentucky, she's there, works in their experiment station, and she's in charge of grants and grants operations. And I'm a faculty member at Purdue, and I'm in charge of using grant money. So over the years, Leslie and I have worked on a number of big projects together when she was at Purdue. So we put this talk together to help people understand the whole process of getting grant money and how you do that and what you need to think about. And I've worked into this talk a whole lot of other sort of sidebar issues in terms of kind of early career issues and in that kind of situation. Can everybody see this okay? Is that all right? Okay. So when we start thinking about grants, it's really a situation of, I've been at Purdue since 1985, and one of the first things I did at Purdue was write a grant proposal. And I had no idea what I was doing, and people now come into a university, they have big startup packages and lots of dollars and stuff, and what I got was a tablet of paper and four pencils. That's my standard joke on what my startup package was. And it wasn't really good paper, so the pencils worked, but paper wasn't all that great. So we started writing grants early on. I mean, I've been writing grants for my entire career, and this is sort of the cumulative, this talk is sort of the cumulative of all that information. So if you want to start and then stay in academic research, you really need to get this proposals and grants things working out. I mean, you've got to get on it right away, and you got to throw in an occasional paper. You know, that helps a little. But it's really proposals and grants are where this business is going, and it's not going, it's there. And it makes it imperative that you really learn sort of the nuances of this whole area. So what are the motivations for a proposal? Okay, you got the obvious ones. Answering kind of a fundamental question you're interested in. That's a good reason to write a proposal. Solving a problem. You can write a proposal to solve a problem. You can write a proposal to work things out. And then, you know, you can use it for funding to transfer knowledge to this generation, the next generation. So that's part of the overarching for the proposal writing. Now, on the little more on the practical side, promotion, that factors in there, right, for proposals. Prestige, you know, you get the grant dollars, you get the students, you can get the publications, you can get admiration. The two aren't always linked, but it helps. And you can get more grants. Okay, so once you start down this road of getting grants, you'll want more grants. And so it's sort of a self-fulfilling a bit in that once you're able to write a grant proposal and get funded, you're going to want to write more grant proposals to get more funded because your program starts to evolve and get bigger and get hungrier and demand more resource. So it's a process by which if you're successful, you have to be more successful later. So it's sort of an interesting phenomenon that occurs. So where do the ideas come from for proposals? My first ideas for my grant proposals actually came out of my prelim process. I went to Washington State University, and we had a written prelim process. And during that process of studying for prelims, I kept track of things I was interested in, sort of on a separate sort of sheet of paper, and those sort of formulated the base of what I was interested in working on when I first got to Purdue and first started writing proposals. That's sort of, it's good, but you really need to start thinking about your ideas for your proposals, regardless whether you have prelims or not. But as you start finishing up your PhD or your postdoc or whatever, you really need to sort of think into the future a bit. Where should you be going with ideas for proposals, and where do they come from, and that kind of thing. So if you look at Steinbeck, he says, well, they're like rabbits. You get a couple, you learn how to manage them, and then you have a dozen ideas. So that's sort of the way it occurs. You started getting a few ideas going, and then and you can, once you have a few, you can get more. Because you can, oh, that works. Well, how about this? How about this? That kind of thing. And I think Edison's, from the proposal from the proposal view, Edison's correct. So the value of an idea lies in using it. And the proposal process is really using your idea. That's really what proposals are, is using your ideas. And proposals are a manifestation of your mental processes on paper. You can have brilliant ideas, but if you can't get them across, your idea won't get you anywhere. And I have the limb here from, we don't work on those anymore, but Purdue was involved with that years ago. And I'm guaranteeing every part of that module had a proposal written about it. And somebody wrote something about it and said, this is why we want to do it this way or that way. They had to put a convincing argument together. And so that would give your proposal, gives your life to your ideas. And that's really what a proposal is at its core basis, is your ideas on paper. And if you sort of view it that way and you sort of take that approach and sort of, when you're thinking about proposals, what's my idea? What do I want to accomplish? Get that sort of in place. That's a really solid way of looking at proposals. I mean, they are kind of drudgery and they're kind of a pain, and there's a lot of crap that goes with it that makes proposal writing a bit difficult on some days. But it's really down deep. It should be your ideas and your approach to this. So, you know, your grad school, your postdoc were hard or could be hard. Things you also need to know is that, and especially right now, the state is not going to provide money. I mean, if you take a job as a faculty member, there's not going to be a huge pile of cash there every week for you. Okay, that's all changed. So new schools will provide you a little cash to start with. We'll talk about that in a second. There are more people looking for grant money now than ever before. Okay, so some of our colleagues in the federal government who didn't go after federal grant funds before do now. So like ARS and a few of the other labs are looking at the same sources of federal funding that you have access to. So you have more competitors. You have more people who weren't in the grant business before who are now being asked to write grants. The extension folks are now being asked to write grants. So it's like spreading everywhere. And the way I look at it was, that was all our money that you guys wanted over here now too. So it's bad in that regard. So there are more people looking for it, and demand does not create supply. So everyone can be looking for it, but there's not any more out there than what we can conjure up. And some of these things I put in here, I've been asked questions over the years. I sort of add this in. One question I've gotten a lot is people referencing back to their major professors, and you can't really rely on your major professor when you go to your job, when you go to this faculty position somewhere. You are sort of now a separate unit from your major professor when you take that first position. So you really need to develop your own program, and grants are part of that. So your promotion package will look a little better if you don't have a lot of things on it tied directly back to your major professor other than publications. More people looking for the money. There's a little bit more money. I'll show you some numbers in a second around, but there's still more people looking for it than there ever has been in the past. And you need to be out there on your own. You need to have your ideas. You need to have your sort of separate yourself from your major prof. You love research, right? You wouldn't be here if you didn't. So that's a reality to you. You weren't interested in doing research. So you need to be good at grants if you want to do your own work and build on your own ideas. So you really need to put that in your thinking about what's going to be happening. And it is very difficult to support yourself 100% on grants, but people do it. One of my colleagues, she's been doing it for 22 years. She pays 100% of her salary off grants. And that's a very challenging position to put yourself in if you think about it. And there's more and more of that going on. There's more hires that are being made in College of Agriculture where a good part of your salary is supposed to come off grants. You start looking at 10-month positions. So those other 2 or 3 months, depending on how you're counting the year, will be off a grant. So that's very difficult. That's a 30% of your salary could be off of grants in the future. So there's issues there in terms of this as well. So there's all kinds of realities. So proposals and grants are now your life and your reality. They can be all-consuming. But that's the way it is if you want to get in this business. Now, I'll tell you this story that just occurred to me, which is good and bad, depending on your perspective. I was at a meeting 3 weeks ago with EPA, and a guy comes up to me and said he'd been to this talk 2 years ago. And I said, oh, great, what'd you learn? He says, well, you changed my life. Okay, I don't get that comment very often, so I pursued it. I said, well, how did that change your life? And he said, well, I went to your talk and I realized I didn't want to do all the things you talked about. I said, what do you mean? He says, well, I didn't really want to spend all my hours working on proposals and all this other stuff. And so I said, well, what'd you do? He says, well, I work for EPA now. He says, I love this job. And I said, so my talk talked you out of becoming a faculty member? He said, yeah, it's great. So I had never really put that as part of my perspective on this talk. I always sort of view it from the you want to become faculty, here's what you need to do kind of perspective. But he took it the other way. He said, I don't want to do that. And he did something else. And he was very happy. It was a very positive situation. He'll regret it later, I know. No, he won't. He was doing really well. So it was a good. He said it's great that he had a chance to hear all this. So this is an easy process, right? You just get this request for a proposal, which I'll describe in a second exactly what that means, and you write a proposal. Is that all you got to do? Well, you got all this other stuff that occurs. Off to the side there. You've got your life, which you will have something resembling a life at some point. You got teaching, you got papers, you got reviews, you got committees. You have all this time basically drifting away from you. Some weeks, I don't know what happens between Monday and Friday. You feel that way sometimes? You start on Monday, you have all these great intentions, and suddenly it's Friday afternoon, and you haven't really accomplished anything on that big long piece of yellow paper you had sitting next to your computer. That doesn't change. That gets worse. Because all those things, there's all these what I call time draws that just pull your time away. When you're writing a proposal, the one commodity you have to control is your time. Okay, you've got to figure out a way to maintain and control how your time gets used in that process. Because all these other draws are occurring off of your timeline for your proposal. And that affects the quality of your proposal, basically, is the situation you get into. So the way we view the world of proposals, and this is a terrible thing to tell you, but it's how many weekends until the next proposal's due. I mean, that's a really sad thing to say out loud, but that's basically the way we look at proposal development anymore, is how many Saturdays can I squeeze in between now and the due date so I can work on it. So it's sort of keep that in mind. It's time that you have to control, and the whole proposal process is really about time management. It's ideas and a bunch of other stuff too, but time management's a huge part of what goes into proposals. A few terms here, just because I used to throw these out, and I thought everyone knew what they were, and which isn't the best thing to do. It's sort of anti-teaching style to do that. But so RFA, which is a term you'll see a lot, is a request for application. Okay, and these are federal government terms, so that there's variations on all this stuff, but. So that ends up, and it's all the legal mumbo jumbo there with it, but that ends up in the awarding of a grant most of the time, RFAs. And then you get RFPs, which are requests for proposal, which will end up typically awarding a contract, though you can't tell them apart from a grant. But it's a legality of it is there's differences between grants and contracts. Okay, so a lot of what we end up getting are actually contracts and not grants, though we don't think of them as any different, but there's some legal issues in there. So RFA, RFP, two words you need to kind of know, request for application, request for proposal. Basically the same thing. Some of the things on the tail end are different, but you won't view them as that much different in terms of how you pursue them. So the difference between a grant and a contract is, a contract is an agreement where the sponsor often is more involved. And you're seeing more and more of this in terms of federal programs. The awarding agency wants to have a part of your time later on. Not only are they giving you the money, they work with you once you get it. Okay, that's an interesting approach, and it can be good. It can be a really good situation, but you need to understand if that's what they expect. If they expect to come back and work with you on some things and have some involvement with you later, so that you need to know that up ahead. A grant is a is actually the ideal world would be you to get a continuous stream of 5-year grants for the rest of your life. That would be great because you get very little program involvement with those. So they give you the money and walk away, basically. And you file a report at the end. But you're seeing a lot more in the contract world now in terms of the federal agency wanting to have some interaction with you about what's going on, maybe wanting you to do this or work with this group or that group or make comment on something you're doing, which is fine. You just have to know it when you get the money. Indirect costs, you guys familiar with that term? Sort of, maybe some of you. Indirect costs are what your unit where you work will charge on the grant. Okay, and there's many ways of calculating it. Something you need to be aware of when they say the total grant funds available will be $300,000, and your university has a 52% overhead cost rate, which is the next indirect cost rate. You're not going to get $350,000. You're going to get some part of $350,000, and your school will get some part. And that's all federally negotiated, and it's all arranged beforehand, and you have to deal within that set of rules. Okay. Now, some agencies won't allow you to charge overhead and charge indirect costs. So that's a different negotiation. That's something you need to look for as well. But USGS has some programs don't allow indirect costs to be charged. USDA charges a different kind of indirect rate than NSF does, which is different from DOE. So even our own federal government, this will come as a shock, has many different things for the same kind of programs. So there's many different rates and many different things that are out there. Where does all that money go? It goes for things like buildings and pays for the lights, and it pays for the parking lot and the cement and all the kind of stuff. It's all federally negotiated, okay? It's a big, I've seen the sheet at Purdue. It's a one-page sheet that says, it's an indirect cost rate calculation sheet. And basically it starts at the upper left-hand corner and goes to the bottom right-hand corner, solid equation the whole way with little things that add up. It's fractions plus, right? So it's 0.00 times the amount goes to this and goes to that. So everything's all negotiated ahead of time with the federal government. It's a very legally intense process, and it's highly reviewed. So it's not just a slap together thing. So your indirect cost and your indirect cost rate, something you need to be aware of. When you're writing a proposal, you need to factor that in, and don't overspend your money when you're going to have somebody pulling some out for internal use. Now, at some schools, you get some of that back, and that varies per school. And we don't get any back at Purdue directly, but other schools do get some of the indirect cost money back in some capacity to the faculty member. So you need to ask about that as well. Do I get some of my indirect costs back? And you should look very happy and anticipatory, like, yes, give me the money back. And maybe you can convince them that you're okay and different. Okay, so the other thing is this has turned into a pretty easy world in finding out what's going on, okay? And that's all because of the internet. All right, and you really need to take advantage of the tools that are available to you. There are many ways of getting information on this business, okay? There are the Community of Science, which is COS. You should join that if your school belongs to that, and develop a funding profile capture device, whatever they call it. It's off your work, it's called a workbench, and you can develop a little profile of things you're interested in. You'll get an email every day that tells you what programs have released grants in your area. Okay? You can go to grants.gov, which is the plus and the minus of your new existence is grants.gov. It's anybody dealt with grants.gov? All right. We have some victims here already. Good. Grants.gov will eventually be a pretty effective tool when they get all the bugs worked out of it. And then what that translates to is there's a couple of federal agencies that are kind of holding back on being part of Grants.gov, NSF being the biggest part, one of the players. But Grants.gov will eventually be the one place you can get all your information taken care of. You guys can come up and sit down. Don't linger in the back there. Don't act like me. All campuses probably have a grants office of some sort, right? There's somebody on your campus that'll have a grants program office, and you should get in contact with them and see what kind of services they provide in terms of this kind of information. You can also get a copy of the foundations directory, and I'll talk about that later in terms of information about foundations. The foundations are kind of a funny thing, but there's lots of information about them around, so you can get that information. So the thing I want to stress here is, you really have to be responsible for yourself in this world, okay? And it's this is sort of the good and the bad part of the internet now. You can do things like Google Alerts, which I use a lot of. You guys use those? Anybody use Google Alerts? Look into Google Alerts. You can put very clever things like the name of the program into Google Alerts and make a Google Alert for it. And then when that program gets released, it will send you your Google Alert. Google will send you information about it because of the way the alerts work. You should look into Google Alerts. They're kind of fun for all kinds of things, but. All the federal agencies have email programs. They all have RSS feed lines, and they all do Twitter now for programs, okay? So every one of them does. And you go to their websites. I get all that stuff from USDA. I get a Twitter, an RSS feed, and an email when there's a proposal opportunity opened up. And I still miss them, okay? Because it's like, what's, I got more junk on my email. This is great. And just delete it. But no, it works pretty well. There's no reason you shouldn't know what's going on anymore. It used to be they would circulate this little piece of paper would come out from our office about 2 weeks before the deadline telling you the proposal was due in 2 weeks, but it would have been 4 weeks old because it got lost in the mail somewhere. All that's gone. And you are now able to get things almost the day they're released from the federal government. So you could have the most time possible for working on something, okay? So join all this stuff. Get all this stuff. Get on all these lists. Whatever agency you want interested in, get on their list. Join their list. Set up your 15,000th password of username combination and just get that stuff, okay? I mean, it's there. And your colleagues, are all doing it, okay? No one's missing a beat in terms of the information. Everyone's going after the information. And you can get, like at the bottom one, here's a Twitter from COS. It's called RefWorks, and that's a COS is a Twitter that comes out with grant information in it. It's from COS. They send the Twitter out on grants. So again, this stuff is available. Get it. Don't miss it. And you get the standard paper versions of things. This is grants.gov. This is a pain, but it does work. And if you are in the grants business at your new university, wherever you go, whatever you're doing, you really need to get familiar with grants.gov, okay? Because you're going to use it at some point. You're going to have to register and go through all the hoopla. The download, the little thing you got to download to work on your computer. Know whether your version of whatever it is will work with this or not. I mean, there's lots of little nuances. You don't want to wait to the night before this proposal is due to discover, okay? This is typically when you discover your software doesn't work with grants.gov, about 3 hours before the deadlines are due. Oh, look at this. I need to download what and do what? But you don't want that. You want to be ahead of all this. You want to get out there, look at all this stuff, understand what's going on, understand how all this stuff works. And they've really done a pretty good job of late getting this system to work pretty well. Grants.gov is pretty functional. The one thing I would tell you is on a big program, never wait to the due date to submit it, okay? It does bog down. We had a call, there was a call last fall where Grants.gov was handling a really big program, a stimulus package program. At the same time, they were handling something for DOE, and the thing basically broke for a day, and they fixed it, but they gave us extra time, but it does bog down, and you don't want to be caught in that. So if you can get a couple days ahead or see what's going on in terms of due dates and things and sort of play that with grants.gov, you're better off. Again, be responsible for yourself. We have at Purdue some very good people who help us who are responsible for me occasionally in terms of when things are due, which is nice, and most schools do have that, but we knew something was going on because grants.gov wasn't working right. So she checked on it for us and found all this out. So grants.gov will be eventually the one-stop place you put everything into. It's not completely there yet, but the federal government is trying to move this way, and they will be there within 4 or 5 years to everybody going through grants.gov. They also can allow you to set stuff up. This is what I wanted to show you, is you can go into grants.gov and you can build a funding advanced search thing here and search for stuff. So you can go in there right tonight when you go back to your hotel room, they're quietly sitting there, instead of watching, what's on Monday nights? Football. Instead of watching football, I was going to say 2.5 men, but instead of watching football, you get your laptop out and you're paying your $19 an hour for whatever the charge in your room is for internet. Try this out. Check it out. Go in there in grants.gov and put in the keyword, okay, and see what you get. What you'll get is a lot of stuff. And the funny thing about grants.gov is it's really important. I have a pointer, but it's really important to make sure you hit that little button down there that says search in, open, close, or archived opportunities. You don't just go with the opened ones. Don't go with everything else because you get like a bazillion otherwise. But what you can do is you can look at the closed stuff and you can see what they funded in the past. So programs that are not presently open, but you may be interested in, they may be coming back around. So you can see what's going on in the historical record. So again, this is a really good resource. Okay, it's great. But don't wait to the last minute and say, well, I need to write a proposal by Friday. I wonder what grants.gov's got. But no, it doesn't work that way. But it gives you a tool to look at. It gives you a way to look at things in terms of programs. So if you look at grants.gov, I did a little bit of work for you. There are 44 federal agencies that run through grants.gov. You didn't even know there was 44 federal agencies, did you, that give out money? The thing you need to know about grants.gov also is it's just not for people like us, for research types. If you sell stuff to the federal government, if you sell steel or toilet paper or airplane parts, you're going through grants.gov for most of your stuff, okay? So that's why it gets bogged down. When they're doing all that stimulus money, when they're selling bridge parts and putting up new roads, that was all going through grants.gov also. So that's why it bogged down. So it's just not the research community, it's the contract community as well. So there are 44 federal agencies providing support. Federal programs total $55 billion in available grant and programmatic dollars. Right now, when I did a little quick search on there were 1,900 calls listed, but most of them were closed. Okay, so that's what I remembered about searching on there. And when I sorted all that out, of the open stuff that's out there, there's 230 that would say environmental as a keyword, 36 in agriculture, not good, and 130 in natural resources. Those are open calls of some sort or another. That could be for funding of a bird watching station for some place in Michigan. I mean, that's the sort of thing you have to factor out with grants.gov. It's not just for big end, high end research. It's all kinds of stuff in there. In 2009, grants.gov, there were a total of 309,000 submissions. Okay, that's 54% over the previous year. That reflects all that Recovery Act money. Okay, there's 64,000 Recovery Act submissions. So that's the kind of traffic they do on that website. That's just why it bogs down right there, 309. And I swear they were all on the same day I was trying to submit something. So it was just miserable, because you can tell when grants.gov is having a bad day, because there's a point where you log in where it just sort of sits there and that little wheel spins. Yeah, it's a bad day. So the woman who works for us on all these projects told me that she likes to submit stuff at 2 in the morning. She said that works out really well, because there's not a lot of business going on at 2 in the morning, because you get across the whole country, there's no one working at 2 in the morning. You sort of cancel out California and New York that way. So it's a really good time to submit. So I thought that was pretty ambitious. She wanted to submit it 2 in the morning. So this is a schematic from the Economic Research Service on billions of dollars for grants. This is 2013. It's set for $2001 dollars, so it's all normalized. So the what you see here is this is agricultural R&D funding, private and public, over the last few years. And you're looking at around $4 billion sort of scattered around in different places and things. So it's and that's a lot of things going on. That's state, that's federal, that's et cetera. That's the sort of the total infrastructure support for R&D and agriculture. It's a lot of money. We don't get that access to a lot of that, but it's out there. So this is in terms of research by agency. This is a little more interesting to you, because this is the world you're going about to enter into. The big blue bar you're seeing there, that's all the NIH money. You're not very competitive in NIH, I'll just tell you right now. I hate to tell you that, but it's not a world we get into too often. NSF's in the red bar, DOE, DOD, Department of Defense, Department of Energy. And then, down that little green bar, down at the bottom there, right above the blue, all others, that's us. Okay. That little bar where I get that big, giant, the arrow I think I drew is like bigger than the whole collection there across the whole, that's USDA money. So it's part of the federal profile. It's not as big as NIH by a lot, by a long shot. So NIH and NSF are the two main players, and everybody else gets mixed in there. USDA is at the bottom there. And then this is a little bit more of a confusing graphic on environmental sciences, and it's buried down in the bottom of the collection there in terms of what's going on. This is NIH up there in that big green bar on top. It's a huge amount of dollars flowing to NIH. This is constant. This is adjusted for 2008 dollars, but we stayed in environmental sciences, have stayed relatively flat in terms of available support. So what you're seeing here are two profiles that are important to you, that when people talk about federal grant dollars and going up and getting bigger and available, a lot of that is NIH money. And it's fairly difficult for us in either environmental sciences or agricultural sciences to get into the NIH money, unless you're in animal science. And then you can sort of start drifting that way. Or if you're in some kind of work in biochemistry or work on cancer, then you can move towards NIH dollars, and you should be moving towards NIH dollars. So there is some good news. This is something I've never reported before. The ARS is reporting a 6.3% increase over fiscal year 2009. So that's pretty good. That's a 6.3 increase, and we don't normally use that I word. We usually use stable funding, which is basically saying negative, or we actually use the word negative funding, where things are going down. But the National Institutes for Food and Agriculture, you guys familiar with NIFA? Okay, that's the new term. And if you wanted to create a Google search for fun, I would put that National Institutes of Food and Agriculture on a Google search. Anything to do with that agency will pop up. Or you can put that with grants, and then you can get a Google, a little search in there, and you can see what's going on. They have a 12% increase over, so the R&D program, which is where your dollars will come from, is sitting at $800 million, basically, in the R&D part of NIFA. Okay? It's a lot of money. It's up a bunch from where it used to be. The goal in that program is closer to $1 billion, I think. But right now, it's on the way up. NRI money, some of you probably went to grad school on NRI money. I'm guessing your major professors or somebody paying you off NRI money. NRI has gone away. It's now called AFRI, which is Agriculture and Food Research Initiative, which is part of NIFA. Okay, you got to get your letters. You got to get your alphabet soup worked out. So USDA CSRES is now NIFA, National Institutes of Food and Agriculture, kind of like National Institutes of Health. See what they're trying to do here? National Institutes of Health has billions of dollars. We have millions of dollars. We're trying to sort of move in that direction, which I think is a really good idea. It's a very organized approach to trying to increase our base funding. So the NIFA program has received a considerable amount of an increase, which is $61 million is a lot of money in the program that's going up. So things are pretty good right now, actually, grant funding-wise. The total volume is not great, but the fact that it's in the positive direction is a very positive and good thing. So as you're coming out into this lovely world we work in, there is a bit more money available. So let's crush that reality for you a little bit. What really defines a lot of this is success rate, right? So the NSF success rate is about 21%. Okay, so 21% of those submitting will probably get funded. Amount average is about $110,000 of NSF. That's average. Now there's all over, I mean, the standard deviation, that's huge. And the mean duration is 3 years. Okay. So NSF, people think NSF has lots of money to give away. They do in some programs. Some of their big centers programs have lots of cash, but typical single or dual PI investigator grants aren't that huge. So the AFRI program, the total amount is 3% of the total NSF dollars. Okay. That's a little thing to start with. So NSF is a lot bigger program. They had about 1,900 applications last year, or 2007, sorry. 22% were funded, okay? So, that's not bad. It's about a quarter. Yeah, it's not bad, right? Well, there's a little secret that 22% funded includes lots of other little project areas like conference grants and all these sort of little things that they fund that all gets counted into the 22%. So it's a little off from the actual research funding gets calculated in there. It's a little lower than 22, but still pretty good. 22% chance of getting funded. Some programs are much, much more competitive. Some programs are in the 8% range, some of these areas. I mean, that's not a very high funding rate, 8% of submitted. But 22 overall is not bad. 10% went to EBSCOR, which is, depending on what state you're living in, is valuable to you. If you're an EBSCOR state, find out you're an EBSCOR state, use your power. Because EBSCOR is a good program if you're in the right state for it. If you're not in an EBSCOR state, you can't apply to the program. And then 1% went to new investigators. Okay, and what's a new investigator? That's someone who hasn't had federal grant support before. Okay, the way federal grants, the way new investigator money gets allocated is it's usually at the tail end of the review process on a panel, and there's some money left over. That's how new investigator dollars get applied a lot of times. You want to be in the other part. You want to be in the part where the regular funding is, and then you don't want to try to rely on new investigator money. Anyway, that's sort of the dollar sense of what's going on, where things are, what's happening out there in terms of grants last year. So EPA STAR, You guys heard of Star Grants? It's a really good program. Star is a great. I've had Star money on and off for years. It's great. It's a great program. They don't have very much. It's an R&D part for US for EPA. They have huge numbers of applications. So and they don't fund all that that many. The this is their fellowship program. They awarded 140 new fellowships last year. And you guys in Star Fellows? That's a great program if you become a Star Graduate Fellow. It's a very lucrative way of going to grad school. If you have colleagues or friends or who are interested in that, they should look into that program. I just wrote letters for a bunch of people on that, so it's good. States? States don't have any money. Anybody from California? All right, yeah, you're the perfect example of a state without any money. It's a negative source for money there. They're taking people's money in California now. State agencies are kind of they're interesting in that they don't have huge programs, but they can have very lucrative programs. If you are in an area someone's interested in the state, you can do pretty well with a state relationship. And that's really develop a relationship with staff, and then flexibility in what you want to work on is really the key to getting funding out of them. So you can work with them on, you get invited to give a talk at a state function, let's say on water quality, which I've done a bunch of times, some issue. I always go, okay, because you never know who's going to be there, what kind of programs that they're going to want, who's doing what's going on. So you got to work with these folks and help them out, and then they can be pretty helpful later and coming backwards on you. Industrial money is highly individualized, okay? There's no rule of thumb about industrial money. I can tell you one thing is they tend to not have RFPs or RFAs or anything else. They tend to be one-on-one, somebody's got a problem, somebody's got a question, and they'll work with you on that. One thing that the industry seems to be getting interested in more and more in is supporting grad students. They're having a hard time finding employees, so that's why they're interested in supporting grad students. Performance with industry is key. If you say you're going to get something done in 2 years, they don't really want to hear about a no-cost extension. They want products done. That's because they work differently than we do. They want things done on time, in line, and to expectation of what they requested of you. And again, contacts are the key on that. So those guys that went to grad school with you that are now in industry, give them a call. One of the best programs around, it's sort of a hidden program, it's a 319 program. You guys heard of 319 grants? If you work in the water quality, sort of environmental quality area, 319 money can be very a good way of interacting with the state. It's basically federal money that runs through the state environmental agencies. All states have 319 money, and you don't do research on 319, but you can do management stuff. You can do observations, data collection, just don't call it research. And it's a very good way of working with the state, because you're not spending the state's money, you're spending the federal money, but it works out pretty well. So if you're out there and you work in the environmental area, 319 is a good place to look. Foundations. I get a lot of questions, so I flipped this around some. A lot of questions about foundations, and they're very tricky. Okay, foundations are not like a granting agency. They have money that belongs to them, and they're willing to share it with you. Okay, as long as you have a mission that looks like something they're interested in. And there's like national general purpose foundations. These are big, broad interests. You get special purpose foundations. You get community foundations. You get family foundations. There's all kinds of foundations. That foundation guidebook I showed you the name of early on, you need to look at that in terms of potential for money. Foundations are, the other thing you get into with foundations is that your campus may have a foundations relationship officer on campus somewhere in one of those big buildings you don't go into too often. You need to work with that office on foundations, because there's all kinds of nuances involved and things. But foundations can be very good, but they're sort of tricky in terms of what's going on. They typically fund a lot of education stuff. They're interested in things that have an impact. If you look at the Gates Foundation, they have very specific guidelines on what they want to fund and where they want to fund. And it's not really an open call. It's sort of their ideas. And if you can come to them with a way to meet their ideas, and they'll talk to you. So higher education is pretty good in there. They have a lot of K-12 stuff they support in foundations and research. It's kind of a mishmash on how you do it. But foundations can be lucrative. We had a big foundation grant. I was part of that, I guess. And it was very specific about what it was after in terms of the impacts it was looking for. It wasn't like just do research. It was accomplished the following six goals. Okay, so that's all the background stuff. That's where all your sources of money could be. Federal government, foundation, state government. Call your mom up and ask her for some money. That'd be good too. So now this is the actual proposal stuff. I'll try to go through that pretty quickly. Well, there's a lot of it, but I'll go through it as quickly as I can. I say follow these simple 60 steps to success. That's about right, 60 steps. Okay, you've already started. You're already partway down the road going to grad school. Okay, like I said before, time is critical, okay? So you need to be proactive. You need time to write a persuasive proposal, okay? Especially your first four or five proposals. Four or five? I only wanted five proposals my whole life. No, that's your first year. I have colleagues that write a proposal a month. It's amazing. You have to think about your time management for proposal development. And you might as well start now. I mean, really, if you're sort of in grad school and you're postdoc and you're sort of finishing up and stuff, you need that time to create the proposal. And if you keep waiting and you push deadlines and you're a procrastinator, all of the other things are all going to work against you in terms of a proposal. Okay? It just all works against you. So creative, to write a persuasive proposal, you've got a very limited amount of time involved, and you need to manage that. So if you look at this is sort of the time breakdown. This is stolen from Covey. So you have sort of urgent, not urgent, important, not important, those kind of things. So you need to sort of look at what's going on in terms of your time management. And I know for a fact that grad school and the sciences, we do not teach things like time management. We don't teach things like personnel management. We don't teach business management. We don't teach all those things you suddenly find yourself doing when you become a faculty member. Like the first thing you got to decide to do is some hiring stuff when you first become faculty. And it's like, they didn't teach me this in grad school. I mean, I don't know, what's this all about? And there's lots of things that you don't know from grad school that you suddenly get dropped into when you go out there. And time management is probably the biggest issue there is, as far as I'm concerned. You've got to sort of start thinking about that early on in terms of proposals, papers, how you do things, when you're going to run your lab meetings. These are urgent, important, but not urgent. Urgent things are like personal, professional issues, pressing personal or equipment problems. Those occur. And they usually occur right when you're writing a proposal. It's great. The mass spec is suddenly doing something very odd. And then you get deadline-driven projects, and those are all the urgent things. So, again, start thinking about this now. That how are you going to manage your kind of daily existence in this management matrix? I know you didn't go to grad school to become managers, but you will be a manager. Okay, if your program is successful, you're going to be a manager of a program. You're going to run a lab. It's just not going to be you in there. You're going to have grad students and technicians and folks working for you and that kind of thing. You're managing, and management takes time. It's got to be factored in there. So in a proposal process, you have to manage this workflow, okay? There's lots of things that happen during the proposal writing process that you don't really, that go on. Budgeting, for example. Budgeting can take up a huge amount of time, okay? So the key here is get that stuff going early. Sort of manage that process. Look at the proposal and how it's going to play out and work on that. Budgeting, the cost share, which I'm not going to talk about a lot, but it's part of the budgeting process. The budget justification. Huge amount of time goes into writing a budget justification for the proposal. Start ahead. Think about it. Actually, you should write that when you're writing the proposal. Approvals. If you're working with animals and you need to get the approval of the animal folks on campus, that could take months. You need to be doing that ahead of time. If you're working with people, if you're doing social sciences, same thing. Turns out you can't use little kids for experimentation. Who knew? If you have off-campus collaborators, you need to get all that stuff going. Last thing you want to be doing is turning a proposal in on Friday and trying to get a letter of support from your colleague in Kansas on Thursday afternoon. Okay, it just doesn't go very well. Something always breaks. It's just been my experience. Letters of support, important, critical part of proposals, especially when you're doing larger kind of multidisciplinary proposals. Having those people say, yes, we're going to do this and this. Important, really important parts of proposals have to be handled early. Early, early, early. You got to get it going in there. Because when it's coming down, the proposal deadline's coming up, and you're writing on sections and stuff, and all of a sudden you realize, I don't have a letter of support from the Putnam County, whatever and whatever. And you're going to do all that work in that county, and you have to have that letter. Then what are you going to do? You got to get on the phone. You got to do this, all this other stuff. So, again, time flow. Work at the proposal. Work it through and what's going on. Take control early on these proposals is really the key. So really, here's a question for you. What comes first, the request for proposal or your idea? Okay, that's really, think about it for a second. So what are you going to do? You have an idea, you have an RFP. Well, what do I do? What, do I write to this RFP? I'd maintain that as faculty, you should actually take your idea and develop preliminary data for it before there necessarily is an RFP. Okay, so you get on faculty somewhere and you get some ideas and you sort of start dinking around with them, working on them. And you kind of know what's out there. I mean, if you're in the soils areas and you're going to want to work on nutrient cycling, okay? Let's say you're going to work on nutrient cycling in soil, and there's not a direct RFP out today, but you're interested in nutrient cycling, and you know in the next 6 months there will be. Start some decent experiments. Get some preliminary data going on the kind of ideas you want to put in the proposal. You're going to have a much, much better proposal, okay? Preliminary data is the backbone of a good proposal. Without preliminary data, you are subjected to the whims of the reviewer saying you can't do this. So with preliminary data, you're much better off. You show you can do things and such. So it's really good to start thinking about preliminary data. I got a couple of other comments on it in a second. So you go out there to that job, the first job, and you're looking for ideas and things. You can get all kinds of input from people. You can read and review. You can talk to others. You can, if you ask to serve on a review panel, you can do that. If you ever get that chance, do that, okay? Serve on a review panel. It's a really enlightening experience. And you can get outside your normal comfort zone. And I've done that on a couple of things, total new areas. I've gone to meetings that I shouldn't have been at, gotten ideas on things, and it's worked out really well. Because it turns out, especially in the environmental area, people outside of the environment have a different perspective on the environment, and they sort of think things that are occurring in the environment which probably don't occur in the environment, and you can capture that gap for proposals sometimes. It's kind of interesting. Okay, I maintain and will maintain forever that preliminary data is the driver of a good proposal. Okay, it shows you can do things. It sort of empowers your ideas, and this question I get about, I'm a new investigator, what do I need to do? I sort of put that in the category of age. If you have a preliminary data set from something you've done when you got to your new job or you have from your postdoc or your grad student experience, and you put that in a proposal, you're much better off, okay? Preliminary data is really, really critical. It's not, I can't guarantee you'll get funded. I know for a fact you don't necessarily get funded with preliminary data. I've got some great preliminary data and proposals I didn't get funded on, but it does sort of give you credibility, especially if you're younger in this process. You're much better off with that little bit of chunk of preliminary data in there. So I see down here at the bottom, don't squander your startup funds. So if you go to a new position and they give you startup funds, you negotiate startup funds, set aside some of that to generate preliminary data, okay, as part of an experiment of some sort. I mean, you got to buy stuff too, I realize, but it's good for that. So I maintain the proposal development process should be on par with writing a paper. That's the level this should be at when you're working on this, okay? You should think about the proposal as a intellectual pursuit, okay? You're going to develop a good literature review part in there. You're going to write good questions. You're going to write hypotheses. You're going to write procedures and methods. It's not an endpoint, though sometimes it feels like it. I mean, I'll be honest. It just feels like, oh, I got this submitted. This should be worth something. Just submitting it should be worth something. It's not, unfortunately. It doesn't work that way. It's on your way to discovery. It's a means to allow for discovery. It's again, it makes your ideas real. So it's a intellectual process, and you should really be viewed that way. So you know, this is an old adage here that success equals preparation plus opportunity. Well, the preparation is you getting ahead and doing a little preliminary data. You having some experiment ideas laid out. You're thinking one step ahead, okay, on stuff. That's the preparation part. The opportunity will come along, I guarantee it. Someone will ask for an RFP at some point about something you're interested in, unless it's something really bizarre, but then you just have to tweak it a little. Preparation is not obvious. Collaborators you might want to use are not always obvious. So that's why you need time to sort of work that out as well in terms of what you're doing there. You should never stop learning about this stuff, and you should, in thinking, I think this is really... This is what I feel gets lost once you get on faculty sometimes, is you lose a chance to sort of think about ideas and think about where you should be going with things. Because of all the other stuff in that matrix I showed you, all going on, all around you. It's this sort of, this you're sort of walking into this whirlwind, and you're expected to pull out of that these ideas for proposals. So you need to sort of think about that in terms of getting all this going. So I put this in here recently. So you sort of think nationally in your RFPs, but propose locally, okay? I guarantee every campus that you would go to will have some kind of new investigator award program on that campus, okay? Your ag schools will have it. Your campuses will have it. So you have these big ideas. You want to do this or that, whatever it is you want to do. Parse that up. Submit it locally for funding, okay? What this does is it gives you capacity to build preliminary data sets and publications. It gives you capacity to support students, so you can add students right away. And then and if you don't do that, and this is from my experience on promotion committees, when people on the promotion committee know these internal dollars exist and you haven't proposed for them or gotten them, then they say, well, why didn't they send a proposal to that program or that program on campus? So look at your campus resources as a tool to get you to the federal resources. Okay, so you know campus resources will be a little lower volume of cash, but you can get a lot done with that money. You can get a lot of students. You can get a student hired. You can get a paper or two. You can get preliminary data, all feeding into that big machine of going after the federal dollars. So think nationally, propose locally is in there. Okay, you can't support yourself long term that way, but you can certainly get stuff started. So look at those proposal opportunities on campuses where you go there, and make sure you have your ideas sort of for your big proposal sort of sitting in that local situation. So the other question I get a lot, and this is, again, in terms of the actual proposal, is use your publications, okay? You coming out of grad school or postdoc, you published probably a paper or two, maybe six, maybe eight, maybe one. I mean, it doesn't matter, just some. And in your proposal, do not be afraid of citing yourself, okay? And you can actually use your publications as kind of a preliminary data. It's not really, it's a published data, but you can build towards a proposal with that information from your publications. So don't fear your own publications in your proposal effort. Okay, so people feel like they shouldn't do that. And I've said, why? I mean, we mostly start our proposals out with all our own citations. This says, look, this is what we've done, and this is what we want to do because of what we've done. So don't fear your own publications, all right? They prove your ability. And if you're young, a young faculty member, and you don't have a big, massive lab machine running, publications can really help you in terms of showing that you can do the work. So that's why you should at least get your own stuff in there pretty much as you can, as long as it fits. If you're suddenly working on pesticide degradation and your other work was on plant breeding, it may be hard to tie those together. But if the fit is there, use it, I guess, is what I'm saying. And then the other questions I've had, some of this stuff is just from questions I've had recently, and I wanted to make sure I covered it for people, is quality publications tend to trump quantity publications. Does that make sense, everybody? Higher-end journals will review better in a proposal. Citations for your own work from a higher-end journal will review better than from a lower journal. I'd just say it that way. And you guys all know about the H-index? Anybody know about the H-index? Nobody know about that? Google H-index when you get home. This may be your future. If you don't know, the H-index is a ranking system of productivity for faculty members. And it's based around citations to your work. Okay? And some have proposed it as the ultimate tool for promotion. I'm opposed to that personally, but especially for assistant to associate. But anyway, look into the H-index in terms of what's out there. It's another one of these tools that people are starting to apply against faculty as a way of evaluating. At some point in time, it's going to get flipped into the proposal process, I'm sure. So you might want to look at that early on. Okay, this is actually from an RFP, okay? It says, demonstration of feasibility that through preliminary data or postdoctoral fellowship publication record or of the monitor, whatever it's stuff underneath the line there. But this is what I'm telling you. Use your publications here, preliminary data, whatever you need in the proposal. They ask for it. Okay, they say, we want to know what you can do. Show us through these different things. This also says, I've read these in directions, which is a critical part of the proposal process, often overlooked. Okay? So this other stuff is just, oh, this is qualifications and things. We'll come back to that later. But RFPs will tell you kind of what they're looking for, and most of the time they are looking for preliminary data or some kind of indication you can do the work. So you need to get it in there, worked in there. Okay, so you're sort of sitting there now. You're sitting there thinking, well, this may be not what I want to do. I think that job at Dairy Queen looks pretty good. Probably does, actually. I've sometimes thought about it. So you're sort of starting to build in your life what kind of proposal package you're going to put together, your research portfolio. And this is really something you should think about. What's your program going to look like in 5 years? Okay, what do you want it to look like? It's probably the better way to view it. I mean, what do you want to have? What are the gradients you have? Do you want to do only disciplinary work? Do you want to do short or long-term projects? Do you want to do basic or applied? I'm not real crazy on those terms, but do you want to do individual projects and team projects and scheduling? How do I get all this stuff scheduled together? So again, it comes back to time management and you sort of packaging of all this stuff. So you need to have it. You know, if you don't have calendaring software now, you really ought to get yourself some good calendaring software and start to learn how to use it in terms of all this stuff. But so the gradients and drivers are out there. Disciplinary, short-term, long-term stuff. It's really important that you get through this stuff. I recommend these three books. It's sort of in there. You should really look at some books on this stuff. Advice to New Scientists, Young Scientists, At the Helm, Laboratory Navigators, Proposals, Planning, and Writing, another example. Now, a lot of this stuff is not, proposals, planning, and writing is sort of scientific, but people use proposals all the time, like I said before. So there's lots of examples that are rounded out there. So take a look at this stuff, okay? I mean, there's lots of people writing about these different things, and you should take advantage of it in terms of what's out there. So this is just the first summary of two summaries, but and good ideas, be realistic, clear and simple, easy to read, define your group and abilities, real budget, carefully justified. Those are like early summaries of proposals, so you can sort of think about that. Good ideas, depending on how big the proposal. Be realistic, do not overpropose. That's a really deadly mistake. Clear and simple, clear. I say it later, clarity is key. Easy to read, define your abilities in your group, and then a real budget with justification. So I got, this is sort of like, not the middle, but it's sort of like the middle of the, are there questions on this stuff right now? Anybody have any questions? Because sometimes people forget questions later on. No questions? Okay. Thought I'd put that in there. I was accused of going too fast. So I took collaborative work started with that this time as opposed to the individual PIs, because there's a lot of similarities, a lot of dissimilarities, but there's a lot of similarities. And I think you're going to be thrust into this early on. So I've switched this talk around to put collaborative stuff up front. So I want to spend a little bit of time talking about what you're going to encounter with a collaborative project. Most projects are collaborative to some degree, okay? Think about when you're in grad school. Most of your projects probably have multiple faculty members involved, PIs, that kind of thing. Everybody sort of shaking their head, yes. Now, you go out to go to work, you have to ask the question, how many collaborative projects do you want to be in, and how many different collaborators do you want? Okay? That's a really important question to ask yourself. How do you want to position yourself in this research world? Do you want to have all collaborative projects? No. Do you want to have no collaborative projects? No. You want to get somewhere in between. You want to have a couple collaborative projects and a lot of ones you're kind of in charge of by yourself or with one other person. So I sort of view collaborative projects as being more than two people, because most projects tend to have two people involved, two faculty members involved. It just seems to go that way. When you start getting into these big things, then you can have gigantic collaborative projects. This is out of a recent program that I was involved with the review panel on this, so I'm familiar with it. This is a recent program on integrated organic and water quality program, and the word integrated was in there. So basically what that means is collaborative project, okay? When you say the term integrated, that typically means there's many, many areas they're looking for. It's a collaborative project, okay? So how do you get involved in these? What do you do? And what happens is a lot of, young faculty come into a program, the other people who are there will look at them, and this young faculty member brings some technique or top knowledge that they don't have. So they want to include you. Okay, you need to watch yourself and protect yourself a bit in terms of your time again, because you want to be, you don't want to not be collaborative, but you don't want to just be sucked in as the tail end of all these other little projects. So you have to, again, think about your long-term goal, your 5 years out. What do I want to look like? What kind of mix of programs do I want to have? And sort of write that down and think about it, and then have it in your mind when you're talking to people. You're seeing many, many more of these things like integrated programs, which require multiple people and locations. So how many collaborators? That's your call, but it's you need to develop your external portfolio, and you need to develop your program around your lab group. It's sort of how you spend, not only money, it's how you spend your time. So you need to decide the number of individuals and projects, large and small collaborators you want to have, or you can stand. Okay, collaborators come with a cost. Okay, there's a drain or a drag, I guess it would probably be on that, because each set of collaborators will cost you some energy out of your day to deal with. Okay, so there's you have to keep that in mind. And I would recommend, and I do tell everybody who comes out of my lab the same thing, is that you don't try to start a large collaborative project as your first thing you do. Wait a few years before you get involved. Be involved in a couple of successful ones so you can see what they look like, and then start your own. It's rare to have single PI projects anymore. It's because of this integrated aspect, that multifaceted approach. Many granting agents require that you have multidisciplinary efforts. There's like three or four kinds of collaborative projects. My favorite is the first one, which is linkage by staple, where you send your CV over and they put you in a project and they staple it all together and mail it off. Don't laugh. This is a very common way of collaborative projects get done. It's a very bad way of doing collaborative projects, but it does happen. There's a lot of these forced or middle ones, or these forced or quick linkage projects where it's an RFP comes out and a bunch of people come together who don't know each other and try to write a proposal. It works sometimes. The real problem with those is on the tail end when the project gets funded, then you have a bunch of people you don't know anything about you have to work with. Okay, so the best one are the true multidisciplinary efforts. They're constructed as an outgrowth of a shared idea. So it's sort of collaborative thinking about a project area. And then you guys all sit around somewhere and talk about it, and everyone sort of says, I can do this or I can do that. And then you write a proposal. It's a much, much better multidisciplinary proposal. I've got a couple that I've had that have been wonderful. I've got one right now that's great. That's exactly how it was developed. We had no money, then we had a little bit of money, then we had a lot of money. And that's based around that third construction where we met, talked as a group. And we still mostly like each other. It's okay. It works out pretty well. I've got a couple. That's not the case. So when you're looking at multi versus share single investigator projects, on the single side, you got one leader, one agenda, one business office, one department head, one scientific approach, one set of personal obligations. When you get a multi-investigator project going, especially when you get up above three, this seems to be the case, shared leadership vision, okay, I'm not going to say leadership, I'll say vision. I want it to go this way, I want to go that way, I want to go that way with it. You got multiple agendas, you got multiple offices, you got multiple department heads, you got multiple approaches in terms of scientific method, and you got multiple personal obligations. Okay, so that's, again, time. You're waiting on people now. So it's not just your own problems, you got other people's problems that are causing you problems because they haven't got their part of the proposal done because something happened somewhere else. So all these time drains. So you've got to think about all that in terms of what's going on. This is something I hadn't thought about until recently, and I've been doing this a little bit. So if you're going to become in a collaborative project, you should really think about team building theories. Okay? Again, this is not something you learn in grad school, I realize. There's lots of books written on this. So you should really take a look at some of these books that are out there on teams and team building process. I know it's kind of a business thing and it's like, ooh, but it's a real thing. And you are, read a management book, basically. Get a cheap one. Go to the used bookstore. Pick up something used there. I don't think it's changed that much over the last few years, but take a look at how people manage groups. And it's really important. It won't kill you. I guarantee it won't kill you. So, and then think about it from the leadership side. So you need to, if you're going to be in a project, you need to look about how that's going to be how leadership is distributed within the project. And then you have to develop what I call follow-through skills. All right? If you're going to be in a collaborative project, you have to learn how to follow through. So if they say, you're going to write this section, you're going to write this section, and you don't write your section, you just sucked everybody else's time away because you didn't do your part. So you have to become a member of that collaborative team at a true level of participation. So just because you're in there doesn't mean you are relinquished of your responsibilities. You have to be a responsible member of the group as well. So you need strong leaders and you need strong followers in these collaborative projects. And good project management takes time. It's just this, collaborative projects take time. And then they're kind of fun, but they do take some time. And you just have to build that in. We had this one project I have that's a really good project. I really like it. It's a great project. We meet every 2 weeks. Every 2 weeks we have a big group meeting. Everybody from all over campus comes together. It's kind of a pain. It works. Everyone knows what's going on all the time. We have a lot of email that gets exchanged also. So writing the proposal. This is sort of thinking about this. You got time, you got organization, that's paperclips or organization, I like that. You got phones, that's like an old style phone, it's got a cord on it. Most people don't have those anymore. You got urgent, you got lab coffee, which I do enjoy. The real critical part about proposal writing is real simple. Get your ducks lined up, okay? You've got to be organized. You've got to be prepared for this. I don't care if you're writing collaborative proposals, you're writing your individual proposals. It's getting your ducks lined up. It's critical. Read the RFP. This is the biggest piece of advice I can give you, is read the RFP, or RFA, whatever it is. Read the guidelines. You'd be surprised people who have submitted proposals have never read the guidelines. And they get all offended when they get rejected or something trivial, like, we don't expect proposals in that area. Or, because they'll bounce you right out the door with those, especially electronically. It's real easy now to do that. So read the RFP, adjust your ideas, consider eligibility. If you're not eligible for a program or you don't live in a state that's allowed in the program, don't submit. Move on to something else. Consider the relevance and the review criteria that's going to be used. And you are writing the proposal for the reviewers. Remember this always. You're writing for reviewers. You're not writing for yourself. So clarity is the key on proposal writing. This is typically what you see. This is star stuff, kind of RFPs you get into. Check out, go through the proposal, get your highlighters out, see what they're asking for. A successful proposal will integrate theory, data, modeling techniques to interpret existing field and laboratory experiments. Highlight it. And when you write your proposal, answer that question. Our proposal will... It's in the RFP, put it in your proposal some way so you can line those things up. People review by lining things up. So you go through there. The proposal should describe. The proposal will do this. They tell you what they want in these things to some large degree. It's all written out. Read the proposal, find it, figure it out. Successful proposals will. There you go. They tell you that a lot of times in RFPs. They'll do the following. They'll describe an aquatic ecosystem proposed for the study will be characterized. Huh. If you don't do that, I can tell you what's going to happen in the review. They're going to say, they didn't tell us about the ecosystem they're going to work in. Out the door. Done. You're over. And actually, that's the favorite kind of when you're on a review panel, you love proposals that are totally out of compliance because it makes it, because you get like 10 to review, 10 or 12 to review, and you get a package of them. Well, you get a disc now. You don't get a package, but you get a disc. And you're going through it, and this one's completely out of compliance. This is great because I don't got to read any more of this. So you're done. You just write, didn't make the cut. Or whatever the buzz term is for that particular panel. So you don't put yourself in a position of being an easy kill on a proposal. So you want to make sure you meet their guidelines. The proposal, successful proposal, will. And they'll tell you that. Okay? Read the guidelines. Pre-planning. You guys can get proposals from people on your campus and look at them. And I emphasize two things there. That word successful twice. Look at successful proposals, just don't look at any proposal. You have a colleague that's got a successful proposal, look at their proposal. Okay? Or you go to your campus probably has some somewhere. You want to look at what successful proposals look like, because you never know why something got rejected. So you only look for successful stuff. You can review abstracts of recently funded projects. USDA is very good at this. All the federal agencies list everything on their websites, what's been funded. And then, as you're developing your idea, this is really hard to do, you should get a critique of your ideas from your colleagues. Okay? This is time management. You can't do this 2 days before the proposal's due. You need a couple weeks to get this kind of stuff done, especially on your early ones. When I first got to Purdue, I had to write a proposal to the Midwest Pesticide Impact Assessment Program, and I was looking at carbofuran degradation, and I sent Lee Summers a copy of my proposal. Lee had been at Purdue before I got there. He was then the department head of Colorado State. Lee reviewed my proposal, gave me very strong critiques about this was good, this was bad. I did everything Lee told me to do. I got funded. I don't send things to Lee, but it just shows you that you need time. I did that all ahead of time, way ahead, got it all done. It was all back then. It was all by mail too. It was like, you know, put it in an envelope, mail it out the door, wait by the mailbox for the return. You guys remember mail, the paper stuff you see around? Yeah. This process works. Critical review critiques is important. Now you got to give people time to do that. Anyway, staying on top of the announcements, again, you got to get that factored in, figure out what's going on when, so you have plenty of time to do things. Stay in front. We already talked about all this in terms of disciplinary stuff. Okay, during the process, actually in calling, I suggest you read the RFP, and especially if you're young in this process, even I do it. We just did this 3 weeks ago. We called. We read the RFP. Put our ideas together in a little brief abstract, like 5-10 lines, okay? We emailed it to the program manager and said, hey, take a look at this idea. We're going to call you about it. See what you think. So they did. We called them, and they told us, not in our program area. Okay, we're done. We're not going to go back. We're not going to submit to that panel because they told us to go away. It saved us a whole lot of time. It's much better to get rejected over an abstract than over a whole proposal. That was like, you know, 30 minutes worth of work to get the abstract ideas together. A real proposal would have been 30 days, right? So this is important. Call. These people will talk to you on the phone. Don't be afraid to call them. It's easier if you abstract them, send them an abstract, send them an email first, and then go do some dialogue that way. But it's really important to talk to them. And listen for the subtle changes, subtle terms. Well, in my case, it was we don't support that area. That's not too subtle, but it was like, well, you know, that's not something we're considering that important this year. Ooh, it's a big signal, right? You're at high risk of being rejected. You're listening for, wow, that is a really cool idea. Oh, okay, now we're talking. And you'll get that from program people. They'll tell. It's not that obvious most of the time, but they'll talk to you. So don't be afraid to call. This is the proposal, the process, really, and it's there's nothing like time to make a strong proposal again, okay? And you guys can't wait to the last minute. I don't even wait to the last minute. I've been doing this a long time. You need to plan for writing and talking with your collaborators. Even if you have one collaborator, you need to do that. You need to plan for clearing collaborations. So if you have somebody from a different department, you have to get all those rules covered. Writing and talking again, talking and writing. Writing and talking, budgeting and approvals and budgeting and rebudgeting. Because when you write the first budget, it's going to be 35% over the target. And you have to talk about what you're going to cut. Okay, I guarantee. 35% is probably a pretty realistic overage. Grant processing, depending on your campus, can take up to a week. Okay, so you have to build that in. So it's going to take a week. This thing is due next week, right? You turn it in on this week, it's going to sit somewhere and get reevaluated internally. And they're going to find problems with it, and I guarantee you they'll find problems with it the day before it's due. It's guaranteed. They have it for a week, and they'll find problems the day before it's due. All right? So don't disappear the day before your stuff's due. And if you do go somewhere, make sure they know where you are. So they're sequencing, and it's tough on them. And then early on, especially like I did in my early days, allow time for colleagues to read your proposal. If you have someone read your proposal, and they make comments on it, and you think they're good comments, make the changes and let them know you made the changes. Don't waste their time. If you're not planning on really using their comments, don't have them read it. Okay? You don't want to waste someone's time. And the other thing that I've discovered really recently, and I guess I knew this but didn't really know it, is that with an agency like NSF, for example, that poorly prepared proposals can leave an unwanted legacy. In other words, with NSF, your proposal you submit stays in their system. and so do the comments about it. So be careful what you submit. Make sure it's the best possible work you can put together. Okay? It's important. So in the process of writing, you have objectives, rationale. What are you going to do? Experimental design. Okay, it's critical, important. What are the steps, priorities, and timeline? Important. Do not assume the reviewer can figure you out. They can't, and they won't. What are the outcomes? How are you going to analyze the data? This is a big deal. And this is I've seen this as a death point of many proposals. We're going to collect data on plant growth. Okay. What are you going to do with it? Never stated. No one says. We're going to use an ANOVA to do the analysis. We're going to do this. We're going to test against this hypothesis. We're going to do this or that or whatever. Tell the reviewer what you're going to do with the data. Okay? So they're going to sit there and they're going to say, oh, this is cool. They thought about this. They're going to do this model. They're going to use that model. You may not do that, but at least in the proposal, you've laid that out to a valid case. And then there's a section of the proposal which causes people great deals of grief. And it's pitfalls and alternatives approaches, okay? All proposals ask for them now. So what if this doesn't work? What happens? So it's this panel I was just on, I sort of kept track of this because I knew I was going to be talking here. I'd say 20% of the proposals didn't have this section covered very well and cost them a great deal of trouble on the review. So when they ask for what to do if it doesn't work, then you need to tell them that. So if this approach doesn't work, we'll try this approach, or if that doesn't work, this approach. Simply making the statement, which I have seen, we anticipate all projects working, will not do you any good. Okay, that will cause you a lot of trouble, that statement. So again, you need to lay all this sort of stuff out in the writing process. And if they ask for it, put it in there. Pitfalls, and explain what you're planning on doing if things don't work. So, a well-written proposal convinces reviewers the proposal merits funding. That's the key, right there. And how do you do that? Clarity, clarity, clarity. Okay? Clarity in your hypothesis, research questions. Clarity in your clear objectives, clear outcomes, use of your preliminary data, use of your publications, a clear outreach plan if one's required. If you submit to an integrated program and you don't put an outreach program in there, you're dead. It's not going to get funded. Okay? You can say you're going to write this convincing little story about this or that. If it asks for an outreach program and you don't put one in there, don't bother. It needs to be a good one. No stupid mistakes is also important here. My favorite, of course, is the form and from problem that I seem to have, where the word form is not an incorrectly spelled word. It's an incorrectly used word occasionally, when it should be from. So you have to watch for that kind of stuff, because reviewers love to find that. Hey, look, this guy doesn't know English. So no stupid mistakes, proofread, 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 make sure it's clear. Oh, did I mention clarity again? Clear ideas? Okay. So just make sure it's clear. You want a 30-second message in the front, you want the 3-minute message in the abstract, the proposal is a 30-minute message, and the message needs to be the clearest and the shortest. Okay? You want to hook the abstract is used a lot in review. Don't waste your abstract. A lot of people just are looking really hard at the abstract when they're doing the review, especially when you sort of start the review process. Make it a very convincing abstract. Spend some time on it. Okay, your summary, that little thing you got to write, the little box thing. You need to draw the reviewer into your proposal. Okay, hot, solid introduction, and that abstract needs to be clear. Because everyone I know pretty much reads the abstract first on reviewers. I used to not do that, but I do it now, and it just sort of, I don't know why, it's been a recent thing, and I think a lot of people are doing it. Diagrams are better than words. Okay, these are some points that people wanted me to talk about. Photos can be great in a proposal. You can put all this stuff in proposals now pretty easily if Word will let you do that. Sometimes I've lost figures in my proposals. I don't know where they went. They turn up later, of course, somewhere in the back, floating in the CV section. Procedures are boring. Okay, if you can use a little flow chart to show what you're going to do. I have a friend of mine who always puts his procedures as a diagram. This guy is funded all the time. I swear it's because he puts these figures in. So I've started doing that. So we're testing this model now. Sampling plans are good as a diagram as well. Okay, So you can show little arrows, flows, and things, what's going on, what's going to happen, that kind of thing. It's good. And figures and photos can be used, especially if you're showing some differences, and gel pictures are really good. We use a lot of gel diagrams and pictures, DNA work, so that's good in the figures there as well. And be careful with modeling. You got a lot of reviewers, if you're a modeler, who don't like modeling. And if you get these big pages of equations, it sort of turns them off. So be careful if you're a modeler. And caption information should be correct, okay? This is subtle, but if you say figure one and you have a description that's different than what's in the text for figure one, that's not good. They tend to get lost. Okay, this is the process. This is writing for the reviewers. Again, like I said before, assume they'll be reading at 11 p.m., okay? Don't laugh too much because this is really true. Tell them what they want to know. How is this work going to be useful? What's it going to do? Help them out. And then style matters. Don't make it so hard to read they can't read it. They'll do this. Go on to the next one. And what happens with they'll come back to it, but what happens with reviews is that you get 10 or 12 and you find two you really like. And those are the two that you really kind of rise up to the top of your pile. And those are the two you kind of fight for on a review panel. So you want to be in those two for somebody. So you want to be there, and you want to get them. Readability is important, figures are important, clarity is important, all that kind of flow stuff is important. Okay. Novel and innovative ideas are the best. Grounded in the literature, you got to write a good literature review. Don't just copy your thesis review and dump it in there. Get one that's relevant to the questions at hand. Preliminary data again. Did I mention preliminary data earlier? About 1,000 times? You need that, okay? You need to be working on that, thinking about that. Feasibility, you do your feasibility, especially when you're younger, by looking at your CVs and proving your points with your CVs. And make sure that it's at the, when they ask for the facilities, make sure you cover on your facilities the equipment you need to do the work, okay? If you're saying you're gonna do some kind of synchrotron work, we'll do it at our synchrotron. Well, you don't have a synchrotron. Well, that's not gonna work out very well. So then make sure, again, it's within the scope of the RFP. So what did the reviewer think? Well, I've been a reviewer. Are there dependent aims? Does the whole proposal hinge on the first part of 1A? That's not good. You want to sort of lay out a different strategy in your proposal if that's the case. Is the experimental design consistent with the questions they're asking? So if you have a hypothesis that said one thing and your experimental design doesn't really meet up with that very well, a reviewer will tell you that for you, unfortunately. Are your aims coordinated? This thing's going to build up a little bit in there. Is there more than one way of answering the question? So can you work your way around a failure at one point? So that's another thing reviewers like to look at. And then what are the pitfalls? What's your plan B? Okay, so if it rains all year and you're doing a dry land study, or what are you going to do? What's your strategy? I'm convinced that most of the weather in the United States is controlled by what experiments are going on at any given location. So we've been trying to do drainage work. It never rains. Just about done here. But organization of your life around this is really important. Get everything sort of going now when you get there early on. I set up a filing system for proposals, which basically in my case now is a hard drive location. It's all backed up because there's never a dead proposal. It's just the one that didn't quite make the cut that week. So you can bring that back out and revisit it occasionally. You'll reuse parts. I mean, how many different ways are you going to do fossil lipid analysis? I mean, it's going to be pretty much the same procedure set you'll use for different things. So you want to have those available to you. Set up your CVs. Unfortunately, the federal agencies all have different formats for CVs, so you have to have multiple formats for your CVs. But get those done early again. I mean, it's Thursday. The proposal's due at 9 a.m. Friday morning, and you're writing a CV at 2 in the morning on Thursday. Nah, don't get there. Get ahead of that. Get your CVs together. That way, somebody, when they call you about being on a proposal and they need your CV, then you've got it all done. You can email it to them, and you look really good then. Oh, yeah, I'll send that right over. Shoot it right over to them. Conflict of interest forms, you guys fill those out. You have to submit them on the proposal. They ask for them. If you don't submit them, you're not in compliance. They can reject you over this. They typically don't, but they could. So get those filled out, and your current and pending forms, and they need to be updated. Okay, these are all these forms that the feds have for different things. You need to get all this going as a lifestyle issue. And then always read your comments if you get back from things. Am I about out of time? Yeah, probably over.
5 minutes.
5 minutes, okay. Budgeting. This is something they don't teach you anywhere while you're in grad school. You just think the money flows completely endlessly while you're in grad school, right? I need this, I need this, I need this, and your major professor writes you a little thing, and whoever runs your lab. And it doesn't work that way. Budgeting is really, in the review process, what happens with budgets is the following. People look at the budgets, and there's always somebody on a review panel that really likes to read the budgets. And they'll look at the budgets, and they'll look at the projects, and they'll say, oh, they've over budgeted. We don't really need 3 postdocs for this. There's always one reviewer that likes to do this. I guarantee it's, every panel's got one. And so you need to make sure your budget matches the workload that you're asking for. So if you have some experiments laid out and you've proposed for 5 postdocs, let's just say some ridiculous number, and the work really only requires 1, somebody's going to catch that. And someone's going to say something bad about it on the review process. So when you're doing your proposal, think about the budgets. Think about the number of people you need. Don't under-budget, because the other comment comes up too. They can't possibly do this work with this budget. That's not a good thing either. Think about things like travel and trips. For if you're doing sampling at distant locations, those are expensive. Man, you burn through money like it's going away out of style when you're sampling at a distant location. Okay, it really is a huge amount of money involved in travel. Summer salary, again, that's an important, USDA will pay summer salary for non-12-month employees. Academic year salary, which is a whole different little weird game. Staff time, supplies, disposables, that kind of thing. I suggest you work with your business office, if you can, on this stuff. It's not worth you screwing around with it. You need to be working on the proposal part. You need to get help on this stuff and work with them on getting the budgets run. Okay? They have to be on certain formats of paper, and a bunch of other stuff has to happen. So work with the right people on this. Work on them early, and don't hide this from other people on your project. Okay, this is the other little game that goes on. When you have multiple investigators, so one person tends to be in charge of the budgets. They tend to hide all of it to the very end. Don't do that. Share in this process. Keep this thing transparent in terms of the development process. Makes it go a lot better later. Rules. All agencies have rules, follow them. That's all I'm going to say. A lot of this stuff has gone out because you're getting the electronic submissions will knock you back out with this stuff. So just think about it. Budget justification should match the work and your proposal. And use that budget justification to do that. Okay? Don't wait till the last on that. You want to do that ahead of time. Okay, I'll stop at this point, but the process, the agency's rules, they have the rules, right? They control their money. They make the rules. Guess what? You got to follow their rules, okay? And you can complain and whine and say, oh, I didn't know that. Well, it doesn't matter. There's plenty of people following the rules who get the buy instead. So I'll stop at that point, and if you got questions, I'm going to stand here for a little while. If you don't, you can just run out there and be successful grant writers. That'll be great. Or if you want to change your career and do something else, let me know. Apparently, I'm a negative careerist here.
Anybody have any questions?
A lot of what's in here now is from questions I've gotten in the past. Yeah.
Yeah. Do you have a statistics that 22% or 25% of the projects is funded?
Yes.
It doesn't mean as faculty
with
somebody's 10 proposals,
no, it doesn't work. Doesn't translate down at all. You could go years without any money. It's a no. That's system wide within those agencies on a yearly basis. And again, like I said, that's even a little misleading because that's funding across all of their programs, and some of them aren't nearly as competitive as other programs. Like there's like fellowship applications are different, or conference proposals are different. So that's all of their programs at 22% rate.
Some of it is because people didn't follow the procedure.
Yeah, some of that goes on.
So if you do everything right, the percentage is much higher.
I wouldn't say much higher. I'd say it's probably a little lower, really. I mean, it's not I don't want to sound negative on this, but it's not great odds, even with a good proposal. I have personally experienced the following event where you get review comments back. They say, great effort, and they stack all the proposals up in the room, right? They have like about, let's say they have 300 proposals, and you and yours is ranked, they do a numerical tally of them, and yours is ranked 13th, okay, out of the list. And you're still in the outstanding category. They have funding to number 8. So you basically get cut off because there's not enough money to go through, even though your proposal is great. It just wasn't as great as the 8 that got funded, for whatever reason. So it's really not a, it's a difficult world. There's no guarantees in this. Yeah.
How about resubmitting?
Oh, always. 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 Yes.
To the same agency you had talked to.
If you resubmit, I had some slides on this, but don't hide the fact you're resubmitting, because they'll know it anyway, and use it. So what I've done a couple times is we've resubmitted the same proposal. This has happened about up to three times, to the same program, more or less. And what we'll do is we'll talk about changes we made in reference to the reviewers. So reviewers said to do the following. We did the following. And then one time that got funded the next year. And it got outstanding comments. It was a good before in the ranking scheme. Outstanding, very good, good, fair, poor, go away. It's the bottom category. And we had gone from good to outstanding relative to the references to the review comments. So we did everything the reviewers ask. We told them that on the front page. You're allowed to put that in there. Response to reviewers, right? And we responded to every review comment and what we did and what we changed the proposal. And that actually was one of the comments we got back from the review that year. It was obvious we were paying attention to the review panel and we made these changes that are important, et cetera, et cetera. And we did all that and we got funded. When we just got funded here recently, we submitted it twice before. We ended up having to do some preliminary work, preliminary field work to get enough data to convince them that we could do this project. So that was the first year was like fair. The second year was good on the reviews. It's sort of it's a new investigator I'm working with. And this year they were outstanding because we'd done all this background field work stuff. We converted all the materials and methods to diagrams. We had a very nicely laid out field plan in terms of, again, a diagram of how we're going to sample and do all other stuff. So I'm more and more convinced that the diagram approach, from my own experience, is working pretty well. So.
Any other questions?
Okay. Shoot. Go ahead. We can talk, we'll be okay.
You know, you're a beginner, you know, where can you get some very successful proposal? Because, you know, if you do not have courage, which done on the same work as you, and you may not find their proposals.
Most campuses, most proposal offices will have copies, and you can, Purdue, we have there's a notebook of them. You can check it out and read them. And they're not all going to be in your area, but they sort of lay out the flow of how to do things. So that's talk to your business people or your proposal submission people. That's how you can get copies of those.
Do you have some ideas of where we get pictures or examples of the method diagrams?
It can be on review panels. I should have put that one in. I had this one I really liked. We just did. Next time I do this, I'll put it in to show you the difference. But it's. I'm trying to think of what would be a good example. Actually, some people put them on. The diagrams people put on posters downstairs for those kind of things flow pretty well in a proposal. If you can show a step through and you can show points of departure and those kind of things, it's worked out pretty well. We've used them for field diagrams also. We're doing, treatments and fields, and it's something simple, like just hatch marks and A, B kind of things. It's worked out really well in the reviews. This friend of mine over in a different department, but he loves diagrams. He's the one that really sort of got me going on. He uses PowerPoint to make them. It's just, bars and arrows and puts everything in there. And it's about typically the top half of one page will be a sort of a methods flowchart. In his proposals, and it's worked out really well.
Any other questions?
Yeah.
Okay. Yes, we've been mentioned it briefly, each campus of each university has a different percentage. I'm an administrator, so I'm asking you this question. Do you feel faculty have a tendency to go for proposals which has lesser or the agencies puts a limit on it rather than one which will be the full funding? And how do you actually balance that between the interest of the faculty who write the proposal and the administration which looks at, which is the best?
I'm not sure how to answer that. In terms of the questions about funding, which kind of money people go for?
Yes.
Right now, I would say people go for any kind of money they can get at. That's just typically, it's an accepted truth, I guess, that you'll just propose down to fit that. USDA sets the overhead rate at 25%. Other agencies is up to 50. Well, it's whatever your federally negotiated rate is. And some agencies have no overhead at all. I mean, it just depends on the agency. And I don't really know of people who've preferentially submitted based on overhead rate. I think people just submit and live with the money, whatever they can get.
Can you propose the same idea to multiple donors at the same time, not knowing which will be funded?
You actually have to tell them that now. When you submit proposals to similar proposals to different agencies, there's a little box you have to check off that says you have or haven't done that. So you can't get multiple monies from people, of course, but you can submit the same proposal different places. Now, my favorite example has been recently are these combo DOE, USDA, EPA things in the biofuels area, where there's different overhead rates depending on the agency, and you don't really know who's going to fund it until you go through the review process. So it can come back where they come back from the USDA and they've cut the overhead rate to 25%, or it can go to DOE, which is a full overhead rate. So you have to propose at the full overhead rate because you don't want to be underfunded within your project. So that gets to be kind of tricky. It's been a real a deal in the biofuels area when you get these multiple things coming together. So yeah, we typically are conservative on the we propose to the highest rate, and then if we get something lower, we just live with the difference.